Welcome to the Duck Dive. We're cutting straight to the chase today, diving into a topic that is profoundly human and affects so many of us: anxiety. It's that persistent hum of worry, sometimes that physical tension, that feeling of being perpetually on edge that can really shape our days, our decisions, and, well, our sense of self. We've got a significant stack of material guiding our deep dive today, and it centers around one particularly insightful source titled Navigating Anxiety. From control to authenticity. And this material, that it doesn't just offer surface level tips, it gets right into the foundational understanding of anxiety, what it is, where it truly springs from, and maybe most importantly, why we so often find ourselves stuck in these repetitive, unhelpful patterns. It then offers a perspective shift, a way to move through anxiety rather than constantly trying to suppress or control it. It guides us towards a state of greater authenticity. So our mission today is to unpack the source piece by piece, extracting the most potent nuggets of knowledge and insight. Think of this deep dive as gaining a new lens, really, through which to view anxiety, informed directly by the framework presented in this specific material. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's dive deep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the source material really does get right down to business. It doesn't spend a lot of time on, a formal clinical definition. Instead, it treats anxiety not merely as a fleeting emotion, but as this complex state, a state with widespread manifestations and deep roots, impacting how we think, feel, and behave across multiple aspects of life. It moves quite quickly from just acknowledging its prevalence to describing the very tangible ways it shows up for individuals.
Right, because before you understand why you're anxious, you first have to recognize how it's actually showing up in you. Does that make sense? The source lists a range of symptoms of the felt experience of anxiety. It talks about the significant physical toll first.
Yes, definitely. That constant state of alertness that anxiety can induce is physically exhausting. It really is. The source mentions fatigue, chronic restlessness, persistent insomnia. Just think about what it does to your body to always be expecting a threat, even if it's a subtle one, right? That constant readiness, it just drains your energy reserves, makes it hard to relax your muscles, and interferes with your ability to switch off your mind long enough to sleep. It's the body reacting to these perceived danger signals that might not even be present externally.
And it's not just physical, is it? The mental and emotional impact is profound. The source highlights excessive worry, but like you said, not just casual worrying. This is worry that's consuming, leading to burnout, and critically limiting your ability to function, to enjoy simple things, or even to try new things because the potential negative outcomes feel too overwhelming.
It's worry that paralyzes. That's a key point. The source makes it clear that this isn't just feeling a bit nervous before a big event. It's a pervasive mental state that can genuinely shrink your world. And it calls out some less commonly discussed but highly specific manifestations, too.
Like being hypersensitive, or that phrase that really grabs your attention from the source, being allergic to mistakes. That's a striking image, isn't it?
It is a really powerful one, and it implies something beyond just simple disappointment or regret over an error. An allergy suggests an overblown, maybe even physiological reaction to the presence of the perceived allergen in this case, a mistake or perceived failure. So the source uses this to convey an extreme sensitivity, a state where the possibility or the actual occurrence of error triggers this intense internal alarm system. It's not just wanting to do well, it's a deep-seated reactivity where imperfection feels profoundly threatening to your sense of self or safety.
And that intense fear of getting it wrong, of not meeting that impossible standard, often feeds into another behavior the source notes: procrastination and self-sabotage. It's like you're so anxious about the outcome, about potentially making that mistake, that it prevents you from even starting.
Or you undermine your own efforts.
Right. Subconsciously, maybe, to perhaps confirm the fear and just end the uncertainty. It's strange.
Exactly. It's the ultimate paradox of performance anxiety, isn't it? The intense desire to succeed, coupled with the fear of failure, leads to inaction or behavior that actually makes success less likely. The source also explicitly links anxiety to difficulty regulating emotions, which makes sense. If you're constantly bombarded by intense feelings of worry, fear, or dread, while managing other emotions becomes incredibly challenging, your system is already overloaded.
Which makes perfect sense, yeah.
Yeah.
And it ties into the compulsive overthinking the source mentions. That cycle of worry and then the difficulty managing the feelings those worries bring about, it creates fertile ground for the mind to just spin and spin.
Exactly. Overthinking becomes a symptom in itself, really. It's the mind caught in those repetitive loops, the source implies, driven by that underlying anxious energy and the attempts to predict or control outcomes. You're constantly analyzing, predicting worst-case scenarios, replaying past interactions, all fueled by the anxiety. As you hear these, I mean, do any of these specific ways anxiety shows up resonate with your own experience? This source really helped to differentiate anxiety's many faces, I think.
Okay, so we've touched on what anxiety feels like and looks like based on this material. That's clear. Now let's dig into where the source says it comes from. Because it doesn't see anxiety as just something random that happens.
Right.
But something with identifiable roots and triggers.
That's a key part of the source's framework, definitely. Mm-hmm. Helps us move beyond just labeling the feeling to understanding its origins. And it divides these origins into sort of deeper core sources and then more immediate triggers, factors that can activate anxiety in the moment.
Okay, let's explore those core sources first, the foundational elements the source identifies. Number one, perfectionism.
And the source offers a really powerful redefinition here, I think. It states perfectionism is less about being perfect, more about never feeling good enough. This is crucial. It's not about a healthy drive for excellence. It's rooted in a fundamental insecurity, a belief that you are inherently lacking or unacceptable unless you meet some external or internal standard of flawlessness. It's driven by that deep fear of not being okay as you are.
Which leads us straight to the next core source, the desire for control. Seems linked, doesn't it?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And the source is quite specific about why this desire for control can become so strong and anxiety-inducing. It links it explicitly to formative experiences like upbringing in chaotic or emotionally unpredictable environments or even trauma. If your early world felt unsafe, unstable, or out of your control, developing a powerful need to control your present circumstances, your environment, other people, your own thoughts and feelings, it becomes a natural.
A coping mechanism.
Exactly, a coping mechanism, albeit ultimately a futile one, as the source points out. It's an attempt to create the safety you lacked. But the source points out that this need for control often becomes a source of anxiety itself, because fundamentally, so much of life is uncontrollable.
Yeah, that makes sense. The material also highlights societal conditioning as a core source.
This is a significant force the source identifies, a big one. It talks about our culture's intense emphasis on performance, appearance, success. We are constantly bombarded with messages that our value is tied to our achievements, how we look, how much money we make, how successful we are by these external metrics. The source suggests this creates a deep underlying anxiety because it places our sense of worth on a constantly shifting, externally validated, and often unattainable pedestal. We internalize these standards, and they become a persistent source of pressure and anxiety.
And this societal pressure feeds directly into the fourth core source identified, the fear of rejection.
Absolutely. It's all connected. If society tells you your value is performance-based, then criticism, or not measuring up, feels like a direct threat to your worth, doesn't it? The source links this fear directly to a strong need for approval and an avoidance of criticism at all costs. You become anxious about being rejected, leading you to maybe censor yourself, hide parts of yourself, and constantly seek external validation, all driven by that underlying fear.
So those are the deeper wells anxiety can spring from. But the source also discusses triggers, the more immediate things that can light up that anxious system in the here and now. It breaks these down into internal and external factors.
Right. The internal triggers are those aspects of your inner world, your internal landscape. The source lists things like self-critical thoughts, that constant negative inner commentary that puts you down, high self-imposed standards, which, as we saw, are tied to perfectionism, uncertainty and tolerance, that deep discomfort or fear when things are ambiguous or unplanned, linking back to the desire for control, and emotional dysregulation, which can not only be a symptom but also a trigger, where difficulty managing one intense emotion can kind of cascade into a wave of anxiety.
And then there are the external factors that can trigger anxiety, according to the source. Society comes up again, but now seen as an immediate trigger in our daily lives.
Yes. Specifically, the source points to the competitive, optimization-driven culture. And it makes a really pointed observation here. The anxiety is triggered most intensely when this dominant cultural pressure doesn't align with your personal values. So if you're constantly being pushed to optimize for external metrics like productivity or wealth, but your deep personal value is, say, connection or creativity, that fundamental mismatch creates significant internal friction and anxiety. You feel pressured to live a life that isn't authentically yours.
That's a really interesting point. Parenting and upbringing are also listed as potent external triggers.
And the source provides some vivid examples here. Conditional approval, for instance. where a child feels love or acceptance is contingent on meeting certain behaviors or achievements. Well, that creates a lifelong template for seeking validation through performance. Or growing up in chaotic or emotionally unpredictable environments where you never knew what to expect. That fosters that profound desire for control the source discussed earlier as a core source. The source argues this desire isn't innate. It's often a direct response to past instability.
Social expectations are another trigger, particularly the pressure to only show good sides and hide the not-so-good side.
Oh, definitely. This is fueled by what the source implies are performative interactions.
Yeah.
Especially prevalent today with social media and curated online personas, or even curated real-life friendships, right?
Mm-hmm.
Feel immense pressure to present this polished, acceptable version of ourselves, fearing that if anyone saw the messy or imperfect parts, we'd be judged or rejected. This constant act of hiding is incredibly draining and anxiety-inducing. It demands vigilance to maintain the facade instead of simply being.
And directly related are interpersonal dynamics, the fear of criticism, and the deep need for approval. The source states, we want and need to get approval from others, and we want to keep criticism and rejection at bay to build a sense of safety.
This highlights a central paradox the source identifies. We are wired for connection and need approval to feel safe and belong. But the very fear of rejection and criticism makes us put up walls. The fear of vulnerability prevents the authentic connection that would actually provide the safety and belonging we crave. We want connection, but we fear being truly seen. It's a real bind. Does it feel like external pressures or specific internal thoughts are frequently triggering your anxiety? This section helps us see the patterns and origins this source points to.
That really maps out the landscape of where anxiety comes from and what sets it off based on this material. It's quite comprehensive. But the source doesn't stop there, thankfully. It dedicates a significant part to explaining why it's so hard to break free from these patterns, even when we know they're not serving us. It calls these misunderstandings or cognitive traps. This feels like the heart of understanding the anxiety cycle.
It absolutely is. The source frames these as fundamental problems or, you know, flawed ways of thinking that aren't just symptoms of anxiety, but actively perpetuate and reinforce it. These are the mental loops that keep us stuck.
Let's break these down, as the source does. Trap number one, being admired and being accepted or loved.
This is a core paradox the source unpacks, a really important one. You strive for admiration by being impressive, perfect, achieving things. You think this will lead to acceptance and love. But the source argues that while you might gain admiration for your performance, this is fundamentally different from feeling genuinely accepted or loved for who you are. It suggests that focusing solely on being admirable can actually create a distance, moving you further from the deep connection and acceptance you truly desire. People admire the facade, maybe, but they connect with authenticity, which the striving for admiration often masks.
Trap two. Emotional walls protect, but also isolate.
This is about those defense mechanisms we put up, isn't it? The source acknowledges these walls feel protective. They shield you from potential hurt or rejection. But the critical insight here is that the wall you build to protect yourself also separate us from others. It inhibits the very vulnerability required for genuine connection. You're safe from being hurt, perhaps, but you're also trapped behind the wall, unable to fully give or receive the connection you might crave.
Trap three. Persistent self-evaluation blocks authenticity and connection.
Yeah, if you're constantly monitoring and judging yourself, was that okay? Did I sound smart enough? What do they think of this?
The source says this makes you less available or authentic. Your attention is inward, focused on these performance metrics rather than outward, engaged with the moment or the person in front of you. This constant self-assessment rooted in anxiety about not being enough creates a barrier between your true self and the interaction, widening that gap between where you are and the connected, easeful state you want.
Okay, trap four. We project high standards onto others and relationships. This one flips the script a bit. It's a fascinating insight from the source captured by that phrase, we see the world as we are. If you hold yourself to impossibly high standards, you tend to assume others also hold you to those same standards. You filter their reactions and intentions through your own self-critical lens. The source points out that that's not what the relationship is about. Relationships thrive on acceptance, not performance metrics. And the trap deepens because, as the source explicitly states, judgment of others often mirrors our own harsh self-standards. We judge others for imperfections that we are most afraid of in ourselves. It's an externalization of our internal critic, further isolating us.
Trap five, performance self-worth. This seems like a foundational misunderstanding the source is tackling head on.
It's absolutely central. The source is unequivocal. Performance is not self-worth. We are not all our work.
We confuse our accomplishments, our productivity, our external successes with our inherent value as a person. The source poses the critical question, what is our self-worth then, if it's not based on what we do? This trap shows how we erroneously tie our fundamental value to fluctuating external outcomes, making us vulnerable to anxiety whenever performance dips or external validation is absent.
Trap 6. Success goalposts keep shifting. True rest never arrives. Oh, I think many people can relate to this one. Yes, this perfectly describes the treadmill of endless striving driven by performance anxiety. The source points out that we are never enough despite accomplishments. You hit a target, you achieve a goal, you feel a momentary rush, and then the anxious mind immediately raises the bar. There's always a next goal, a higher standard, a more optimized state to reach. The source provocatively asks, will we actually relax once all items are crossed off the to-do list? The implied answer is no, right? Because the anxiety isn't about the list itself. It's about the internal drive that demands constant validation through achievement. The enough feeling remains perpetually out of reach.
Track 7, all or nothing thinking and over-identification with narrow metrics.
This is about rigid, binary thinking about ourselves and the world. Black and white thinking. The source talks about creating binary self-identities from labels, e.g. smart, dumb, success, failure. Okay. We set up these legit rules for ourselves, where one mistake means we're total failure, one setback means we're completely incapable. The source highlights that we let the one metric we are focusing on at the moment overrule all else.
Yeah.
If you pride yourself on being seen as competent, one perceived stumble invalidates your entire sense of competence in that moment, overriding all past successes or other qualities you possess. The source argues against this, saying we need to view ourselves and situations through many lenses, recognizing complexity and nuance rather than falling into rigid categories.
Trap 8, outsourced self-worth. This really brings the fear of rejection and societal conditioning into sharp focus again.
It does. It ties it all together. The source describes how we outsource our self-worth to people we are comparing ourselves to.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, this comparison isn't holistic. It's on very singular metrics. The source notes, like fitness levels, financial status, social media engagement, career achievements. We pick a narrow domain where others seem to excel.
And then stake everything on it.
Exactly. We stake our whole self-worth on it.
And the result is that precarious, constantly fluctuating self-esteem, up and down.
Precisely. The source states, hence, self-esteem will rise and fall with each comparison. Your sense of value is entirely dependent on how you measure up against others on these narrow, often arbitrary scales. The source does offer a key insight here, though, even within describing the trap. The way out begins by consciously using broader comparison pointers till it falls apart, till it's obvious that it's invalid. By widening the perspective, the absurdity of basing your entire worth on one or two things becomes apparent. This leads to the powerful conclusion the source emphasizes again and again. Only I can determine if I'm enough. I can't outsource this. This is a fundamental point about reclaiming your internal authority.
Okay, and the last one, track 9. We seek control by mistaking emotions as problems rather than signals.
This connects back to that desire for control we discussed earlier. In our search for security and control, the source argues, we've learned to see difficult emotions, anxiety, sadness, anger, primarily as problems to be fixed or suppressed. We often attribute them solely to external events. This bad thing happened. That's why I feel this way. We then try to control the external situation or suppress the feeling itself. But the source suggests emotions are also crucial signals about how we feel inside, providing information about our internal state, our needs, our values, our boundaries, regardless of the external trigger. By viewing them only as problems tied to external events, we miss valuable information and continue the futile attempt to control the uncontrollable, perpetuating anxiety. As you reflect on these cognitive traps, do any feel particularly familiar, like patterns your own mind gets caught in sometimes? This source really shines a light on the internal architecture of anxiety.
That was a really in-depth look at the traps, the why we get stuck part. It clarifies so much about the self-perpetuating nature of anxiety. But thankfully, this source doesn't leave us feeling trapped. It offers a path forward, a shift in perspective and practice, moving from control to authenticity.
And before it delves into the practices for change, the source is very grounded, I think. It lists what it calls fundamental constraints. These are important to acknowledge, not to be defeatist, but to set realistic expectations. Change isn't about eliminating these unavoidable aspects of life, but about learning to navigate them differently without falling into the anxiety traps.
Okay, so what are these fundamental constraints? What do we have to accept?
The source lists four core givens. First, we don't know what is going to happen. The future is inherently uncertain. We just don't know. Second, we can't control what will happen. We can influence, we can plan, sure, but ultimate control over external events, other people, or even our own bodies sometimes is not absolute. Third, we can't entirely separate out ourselves from our performance. Our actions, our work, our interactions are a part of our lives and contribute to the narrative of our experience, even if they don't define our entire worth. And fourth, comparison is inevitable. We are hardwired social creatures. The source acknowledges that, as social beings, we naturally observe and compare ourselves to others. The goal isn't to stop comparison entirely, which is probably impossible, but to change our relationship to it, as we discussed with the outsourced self-worth trap. The source presents these not as problems, but simply as the inherent conditions of being human.
So if we can't control everything, and comparison is part of being human, how does the source propose we move forward? The central theme seems to be living by values, not control.
This is the fundamental reorientation proposed. This is the core shift. Instead of basing our actions and sense of self on trying to control external outcomes or constantly evaluating performance, the source suggests anchoring ourselves in our intrinsic values. And it provides a very specific and, I think, powerful definition of what it means by value in this context.
Okay, let's explore that definition from the source. What makes something of value?
First, the source says a value is self-directed. It's not something imposed from the outside or something you feel you should do. The source clarifies, we freely chose our values. We want them, not we should have them. It's a voluntary commitment to a way of being or acting that is personally meaningful.
And it has intrinsic meaning, meaning itself.
Yes. A value is intrinsically meaningful, even if no one knows. Its worth isn't dependent on external recognition, approval, or outcome. The value is in the act itself, in aligning your behavior with that internal compass. The source gives a great example. Being loved bad, being loving good. Being loved is an outcome dependent on someone else's actions. It's external and uncontrollable. Being loving is a value you can choose to embody, an internal quality and action that is meaningful to you, regardless of whether it's reciprocated or even noticed by others. The source emphasizes that value is under our control, not contingent upon anyone else.
And this definition clearly separates values from goals. That seems important.
Crucially. The source explicitly states, values are goals. Goals are discrete targets you achieve or don't achieve. Get promoted, lose 10 pounds, finish a project. You tick them off a list. Values, however, are described as ongoing continuous. They are directions, qualities, or processes that you strive to live by moment to moment, day after day. Being kind is a value you can practice kindness continuously. Running a marathon is a goal you either finish it or you don't. You can fail a goal, but you can only stop living your values.
That distinction is incredibly clarifying, really helpful. It shifts the focus from achieving specific outcomes, which ties back to performance and control, to embodying meaningful ways of being, which is inherently authentic and less contingent on external results. But how do we actually do this shift in practice? The source offers practical practices for growth and self-compassion.
Right, these are the actionable steps the source proposes for cultivating this new way of navigating life. The first practice is fundamental. Replace judgment with observation. Instead of automatically labeling everything as good, bad, right, wrong, success, failure, which feeds the all or nothing trap, the source suggests learning to simply observe, gathering information instead of evaluating. What's happening? What are you feeling? What are you thinking? Just notice without the immediate layer of harsh judgment.
That requires a lot of mindful awareness, doesn't it?
It does. A real shift. And it leads directly to the second practice. Change our relationship to self-criticism. The source acknowledges self-evolution is inevitable. Normal dose is healthy. It's not about eliminating the inner voice entirely, but transforming it. The goal is to be our own inner mentor instead of inner critic. That's a lovely phrase. The source suggests asking yourself what happened to you instead of what's wrong with you. This shifts the focus from seeing yourself as inherently flawed to understanding your reactions and challenges as responses to experiences. It encourages acknowledging that we are always changing and we can change, fostering a more compassionate, growth-oriented internal dialogue.
Practice three, make room for mistakes. This directly challenges that allergic to mistakes symptom we talked about earlier.
The source is very direct here, accepting a fundamental reality. Sometimes things just don't go well. It happens. The practice is straightforward but profound. Leave room for mistakes. Accept that imperfection is part of being human. Setbacks, failures, errors are inevitable. Instead of viewing them as catastrophes or evidence of your inadequacy, make space for them as normal occurrences in life and learning.
Practice 4 builds on changing that inner dialogue. Change how we talk to ourselves.
This is where self-compassion starts becoming really practical. The source asks a simple but piercing question. Would you talk to your friends or kids this way? Consider the kindness, patience, and encouragement you offer to people you care about when they struggle or make mistakes. This practice is about consciously applying that same level of gentle, supportive communication inward, rather than resorting to the harsh, critical language of the inner critic.
And that directly brings us to practice 5, self-compassion itself.
Yes, and the source goes into detail on the components of self-compassion, framing it nicely as, how would you treat your friends? It involves 3 key parts: self-kindness, actively being gentle and understanding with yourself during difficult times rather than cold or critical. Then, non-judgmental mindfulness, acknowledging your painful thoughts and feelings without suppressing or exaggerating them and without judging yourself for having them. And finally, shared humanity in suffering, recognizing that your experiences of pain, failure, and inadequacy are part of the larger human experience, not unique personal failings that isolate you. You're not alone in it. The core action step the source suggests in moments of difficulty is asking, what do I need right now? Genuinely checking in with yourself about what would be supportive.
Practice 6 is fundamental to shifting away from the performance trap. Change yardstick of success.
This directly challenges the endless goalpost shifting we discussed. The source proposes redefining success away from external achievements. Did I do the thing or obtain the things? Instead, it suggests using a different set of internal, value-aligned questions as your measure of success. Am I living the life I want to live? Am I being the person I want to be? And what is meaningful, impactful, purposeful, fun for me? These questions shift the focus from external validation to internal fulfillment and alignment with your values.
And finally, practice 7, which we touched on earlier as a trap, is now framed as a practice. Broaden comparison.
Yes, it's about consciously applying the insight from the outsourced self-worth trap, taking action on it. The practice is to deliberately broaden your comparison points, quote, to a point when things fall apart, until it's obvious such thinking is invalid and narrow-minded. It means recognizing the absurdity of basing your entire self-worth on a single metric, like your job title or follower count, when considering the vast, multifaceted spectrum of human existence and value. The source reiterates his powerful conclusion here, framing it as the outcome of this practice. Only I can determine if I am enough. I can't outsource this to others. It's about actively, consciously taking back that internal authority. Which of these practices feels like maybe the most challenging for you, or perhaps the one that resonates most strongly as a potential path forward right now?
Wow. This deep dive into navigating anxiety, from control to authenticity, has really given us a comprehensive map drawn from the source material. We've explored the often uncomfortable symptoms, traced the roots and triggers in our past and present, unpacked those subtle but powerful cognitive traps that keep us locked in anxious cycles, and finally looked at the path forward offered by embracing values and practicing self-compassion. It's a lot to take in.
It is. And the source makes a compelling case, doesn't it? That much of our struggle with anxiety comes from trying to control the uncontrollable and from mistakenly placing our inherent value on external volatile factors like performance and the approval of others. It shifts the conversation from just managing symptoms to understanding and transforming the underlying dynamic.
So what does this all mean? This source isn't offering a magic cure, obviously, but it provides a very clear direction. It tells us to recognize the patterns of thought that perpetuate anxiety, accept the fundamental realities of life that are outside our control. And then most importantly, deliberately and consistently engage in new ways of being, shifting from automatic judgment to conscious observation, from a harsh inner critic to an inner mentor, from measuring worth by external achievement to living by intrinsic values.
And perhaps the most empowering takeaway from this material is that final, powerful statement about reclaiming your internal authority. The source repeatedly circles back to the idea that the decision of whether you are enough is an inside job. It cannot and should not be outsourced to the world outside of you. This internal locus of control for self-worth is the anchor for navigating away from the need for external validation and towards authenticity.
Thank you for joining us for this incredibly insightful deep dive. There's so much rich material here to reflect on.
Which it raises an important question, I think. If the source is right, and only you can truly determine if you are enough, what is the very first, perhaps smallest, action or thought you could choose today to begin claiming that authority for yourself, independent of any external circumstance, comparison, or past judgment? What does it feel like just to hold the possibility of that choice?
something powerful to consider. We hope this deep dive has been valuable for you.